Indeed.
In the
I unfortunately
when
have to jump in because we're fresh out of time. But I had to get that question in. I do apologize, Sarah Flounders. Thank you, though, for your input. Co-director of the International Action Center, Olsi Zekci, historian and journalist from Tirana. Thank you for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatavai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. President Raisi says the UN Nuclear Agency's recent U.S.-sponsored resolution is against the spirit of ongoing negotiations to revive the Iran deal. Russia says Israeli airstrikes on Syria are unacceptable and should be stopped altogether. Also ahead, a young man is in U.S. police custody over a tragic mass shooting at a 4th of July parade in Chicago. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's president calls irresponsible a recent resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran's nuclear program. Ebrahim Raisi says the move violates the spirit of negotiations that are ongoing to revive the 2015 deal. Raisi made the remarks while receiving the credentials of the new ambassador of Switzerland. He said the U.S. needs to decide on how to abide by the deal and its obligations. Raisi stressed that Western countries should also take into account their hostile policies would not deter Iran from its developmental projects. He was reacting to an anti-Iran motion proposed by the U.S. and its three European allies at the IAEA's high-level meeting in June. The Iranian president also underlined that the Islamic Republic is ready to expand ties with all countries, including Switzerland. For her part, new Swiss envoy Nadine Olivier Ray noted that Bern and Tehran have had good relations in political, cultural, and economic fields for more than a century. Iran's president says the sky is the limit when it comes to the enhancement of ties with Baku, stressing that this can lead to effective regional cooperation. In a meeting with the visiting Azeri foreign minister, Ebrahim Raisi also called for more public travels between the two countries. He said greater interaction between the people of the two countries will also consolidate friendly ties between the nations. Jehoun Bayrami, for his part, said the bilateral trade volume has increased considerably over the past 17 months. He also echoed Iran's longstanding position that regional issues should be resolved by countries in the region without foreign interference. Bayramov also met with his Iranian counterpart earlier in the day. Hossein Amir Abdullahian called for a peaceful resolution of the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, declaring Iran's readiness to help. Tehran has held the fourth international conference on American human rights. The event reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the U.S. policies. A senior Iranian official told the meeting the U.S. is in no position to talk human rights. Our correspondent in Tehran, Salman Kojouri, reports.
Tehran has organized the fourth edition of its international conference on American human rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception. Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Salman Kojouri, Tehran.
Russia has slammed as unacceptable the recent strikes on Syria that have been blamed on Israel, calling for an unconditional cessation of the attacks. The Russian Foreign Ministry has strongly condemned the attacks as irresponsible actions that violate Syria's sovereignty. Moscow says such aggressions also constitute a breach of international law. On the 2nd of July, Israel carried out fresh airstrikes in the Arab country. Damascus said Israel fired several missiles from the Mediterranean west of the Lebanese city of Tripoli, targeting Syria's port city of Tartus. According to Syrian officials, at least two civilians were injured in the attack. The strike also caused some material damage. That was the latest in a spate of Israeli strikes against Syria. Damascus has time and again denounced Israel's acts of aggression and filed official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. U.S. police have arrested the suspect in connection with a 4th of July shooting in Chicago that left at least six people dead and over 36 injured. Police say 22-year-old Robert Cremo was captured following a brief car chase more than 8 hours after the shooting. It saw a gunman with a high-powered rifle open fire from a rooftop at an Independence Day parade. Separately on the day, two officers were wounded in Philadelphia in what the police called a security incident. The shootings shine a spotlight on the problem of gun violence in the U.S. They come just a week after President Joe Biden signed a gun control bill into law that requires background checks for buyers aged under 21. As I just said, the latest shooting comes just days after the U.S. Congress passed the first major gun reforms in three decades. However, as our correspondent Colin Campbell tells us from Washington, the legislation has clearly failed to stop the gun violence. Take a listen.
Well, we do know that several people have already been killed and several more injured. And this is just another tragic day when it comes to gun violence in America, when it comes to mass shootings in America, particularly on a day that many are supposed to be celebrating their independence. When it comes to gun legislation, we did see some gun legislation passed not too long ago, and this was the most that had passed since the Trump administration when it came to bump stocks, and then several years before that, probably nothing major since the assault weapons ban during, I believe, the Clinton administration. With the latest legislation that was passed into law, we saw red flag laws being implemented. Those who might have been arrested for violence or abuse, they would definitely have to go through a number of checks and balances or even be disallowed from even ever owning a gun. They raised the legal age for trying to buy an assault rifle. They raised that age. There was money allocated for mental health awareness and mental health help for those who need it. So this was probably the most serious and comprehensive gun reform, if one could call it that, we've had in several years. Many have said that it has fallen short, however, of really doing anything profound when it comes to gun access and limiting the amount of guns people can have or the amount of ammunition that people could have. So would this legislation have stopped something like this? I think we have the answer right here, that this incident still occurred despite legislation being passed. So again, this may have fallen short of doing anything serious and profound in the way that gun violence has just proliferated in the United States, contributing to numerous mass shootings throughout the year, like we've had today.
Shelling by Ukrainian forces has killed at least two people in the eastern Donetsk region, which is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. According to pro-Russia forces, 5 civilians were killed and 13 others wounded in Ukrainian shelling of the region a day earlier. Ukrainian officials accused Russian forces of launching similar deadly attacks on civilians. The governor of the Donetsk region said on Sunday that 7 civilians were killed and at least 20 others injured as a result of Russian shelling. Russian forces captured the neighboring Luhansk region over the weekend, marking a significant milestone for Moscow and its war in Ukraine. The Russian president hailed what he described as a liberation of the region, ordering his forces to continue advancing towards the western parts of the Donetsk region. Pro-Russia forces in Ukraine already controlled large parts of the Luhansk and Donetsk regions, which formed Donbass before the war broke out between Moscow and Kiev in late February. Now, Johnny Miller, our correspondent, is with us from the new epicenter of the war, Donetsk. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. Hope you're doing fine. So fill us in on the latest developments.
Well, here in Donetsk, there was about a week in which there was no Ukrainian bombing of this city. We expected that the reasons for that are Russian counter-strikes on the artillery positions just on the outskirts of the city. But a few days ago, shelling of Donetsk began again. As you like to say, there's been many casualties. Yesterday, a market was hit near the railway station. One person was confirmed killed there. And already this morning, I can hear some incoming in the city. So Ukraine, since the beginning of Russia's invasion, indeed, intermittently over the last 8 years, has been shelling civilians here in Donetsk, trying to terrorize the population effectively and trying to inhibit their support of the pro-Russian forces here. So unless Russia mounts some more counter-strikes against those artillery positions, we expect the killing of civilians here to go on for the coming days. It's also important to remember that NATO, of course, is arming now the Ukrainian army, who are intentionally shelling these civilians. Now, further north, of course, where we have the main fighting, the Russian army is advancing there. They've taken Lysychansk. We're not sure yet whether Ukrainian forces will try and set up defensive positions in the town of Sversk, or whether they will try to retreat further to the more defendable cities of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. Meanwhile, Russia is carrying out major strikes around those towns in order to soften up defenses. But Russia is able to make large advances recently after taking Lysychansk.
And how many major cities are there in the Donetsk region, and how many of them witnessed shelling?
Well, it's mainly just Donetsk and the neighboring kind of city, the adjoining cities of Makiivka. Makiivka is kind of sprawling suburban area, so that sees a lot of the incoming. The center of Donetsk is sometimes hit as well, particularly the surrounding districts of the center. The train station where I'm looking to go to just after this interview is not far; it's just on the outskirts of the center, if you like. So that's the major city that's attacked. You also have Golovka as well, which is another city further north from here. That's been heavily under attack, particularly around the villages. Now, the villages are so close to the front line that Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit pro-Russian artillery pieces. But the civilians there, been to one of those towns, it's almost like a ghost town, with civilians cowering inside and having to run to the shop and run back in fear of incoming. So along the front lines, there's many villages which have a lot of incoming. In terms of the major cities, it's just Donetsk, Luhansk now, with the Russian taking the rest of Luhansk. Luhansk is too far away from the front lines to generally be hit, unless it's by Tochiku missiles. Ukraine has fired many Tochiku missiles here into Donetsk. One of them was able to get through the Russian air defense towards the beginning of this war, killing 20 civilians not far from where I am now. Usually, Russian air defense is able to hit down those missiles. Many of the booms you hear in Donetsk, it's almost all day you hear these booms of Russian air defense firing and hitting objects in the sky.
Johnny, thank you so much for giving us those valuable pieces of information. Please stay safe. That was Johnny Miller, our correspondent in Donetsk. Moving on, British Muslims have gathered to condemn New Delhi's failures to stop extremist mobs attacking and harassing Muslims across India. Protesters also criticized the Indian government for its other Islamophobic policies. Robert Carter reports.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with the Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition, and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
The US government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its Belt and Road Initiative. We now present you an article written by Vijay Prashad, an Indian historian, editor and journalist. The piece is titled U.S. Makes Another Stab at Challenging China's Belt and Road Initiative. The article was published by the Asia Times. At the Group of Seven summit in Germany on 26th of June, U.S. President Joe Biden made a pledge to raise $200 billion within the United States for global infrastructure spending. It was made clear that this new G7 project, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, or PGII, was intended to counter the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. Given Joe Biden's failure to pass the Build Back Better bill, with its scope being almost halved from $3.5 trillion to $2.2 trillion, it is unlikely that he will get the U.S. Congress to go along with this new endeavor. The Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment is not the first attempt by the U.S. to match Chinese infrastructure investment globally, which initially took place bilaterally and then, after 2013, happened through the Belt and Road Initiative. In 2004, as the U.S. war on Iraq unfolded, the U.S. government set up a body called the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which it called an independent U.S. foreign assistance agency. Before that, most U.S. government development lending was done through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, which was set up in 1961 as part of President John F. Kennedy's administration's campaign against the Soviet Union and against the Bandung spirit of non-alignment in the newly assertive Third World. Former President George W. Bush said USAID was too bureaucratic, and so the Millennium Challenge Corporation would be a project that would include both the U.S. government and the private sector. The word corporation in the title is deliberate. Each of the heads of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, from Paul Applegarth to Alice Albright, has belonged to the private sector. The current head, Albright, is the daughter of the late U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. The word challenge in the Millennium Challenge Corporation refers to the fact that the grants are only approved if the countries can show that they meet 20 policy performance indicators, ranging from civil liberties to inflation rates. These indicators ensure that the countries seeking the grants adhere to the conventional new liberal framework. There are also great inconsistencies among these indicators. For instance, the countries must have a high immunization rate monitored by the World Health Organization, WHO, but at the same time they must follow the International Monetary Fund's requirements for a tight fiscal policy. This in essence means the public health spending of a candidate country should be kept low, resulting in the required number of public health workers not being available for the immunization programs. As a U.S. government official told me in 2022, the U.S. Congress provided $650 million to the Millennium Challenge Corporation. For its first year in 2004, the amount sought was more than $900 million. In 2007, when former U.S. President George W. Bush met with Nambarin Enkhbayar, the former president of Mongolia, to sign a Millennium Challenge Corporation grant, he claimed the Millennium Challenge account, which is administered by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, is an important part of our foreign policy. It's an opportunity for the United States and other taxpayers to help countries that fight corruption, that support market-based economies, and that invest in the health and education of their people. Clearly, the Millennium Challenge Corporation is an instrument of U.S. foreign policy, but its aim seems to be not so much to tackle the sustainable development goals of the United Nations on hunger, health and education, as George W. Bush claimed, but to ensure extension of the reach of U.S. influence and to inculcate the habits and structures of U.S.-led globalization or market-based economies. In 2009, then-US President Barack Obama developed a pivot to Asia, a new foreign policy orientation that had the U.S. establishment focus more attention on East and South Asia. As part of this pivot in 2011, the then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave an important speech in Chennai, India, where she spoke about the creation of a new Silk Road initiative. Hillary Clinton argued that the US government, under Barack Obama's pivot to Asia policy, was going to develop an economic agenda that ran from the Central Asian countries to South India, and would thereby help integrate the Central Asian republics into a US project, and break the ties the region had formed with Russia and China. The impetus for the new Silk Road was to find a way to use this development as an instrument to purportedly undermine the Taliban operations in Afghanistan. This US project foundered because of lack of congressional funding and because of its sheer impossibility, since Afghanistan, which was at the heart of this road project, could not be persuaded to submit to US interests. Just 2 years later, in 2013, the Chinese government inaugurated the Silk Road Economic Belt Project, which is now known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Rather than go from north to south, the Belt and Road Initiative went from east to west, linking China to Central Asia and then outward to South Asia, West Asia, Europe, Africa, and beyond. The aim of this project was to bring together Eurasian Economic Community, established in 2000, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was set up in 2001, to work on this new, bigger project. Roughly $4 trillion has been invested since 2013 in a range of projects by the Belt and Road Initiative and its associated funding mechanisms, including the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Silk Road Fund. The investments were paid for by grants from Chinese institutions and through debt incurred by the projects at rates that are competitive with those of Western infrastructure lending programs. The US government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its agenda. The report provides no evidence, though, and indeed scholars who have looked into these matters do not see any such evidence. US Admiral Philip Davidson, who previously commanded the Indo-Pacific Command, claimed in Congress that China was leveraging its economic instrument of power in Asia. The Millennium Challenge Corporation and other instruments, including a new International Development Finance Corporation, were hastily set up to give America an edge over China in a US-driven contest over the creation of infrastructure investment globally. There is no doubt that the Millennium Challenge Corporation is part of a broad Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States to undermine Chinese influence in Asia. Only a handful of countries have thus far received MCC grants, starting with Honduras and with Madagascar. These are often not very large grants, although US officials claimed for a country the size of Malawi or Jordan, they can have a considerable impact. No large countries have been drawn into the Millennium Challenge Corporation's compact, which suggests that the United States wants to give these grants to mainly smaller countries to strengthen their ties with the United States. Nepal's accession to the Millennium Challenge Corporation must be seen in this broader context, although the discovery of uranium in Nepal's Upper Mustang region in 2014 seems to play an important role in the pressure campaign on that country. In May of 2017, Nepal's government signed a Belt and Road Initiative Framework Agreement, which included a plan to build a railway link between China and Nepal through the Himalayas. The rail link would allow Nepal to lessen its reliance on Indian land routes for trade purposes. Various projects began to be discussed and feasibility studies were commissioned under the Belt and Road Initiative plan. These projects, more details for which emerged in 2019, were the extension of an electricity transmission line and the creation of a technical university in Nepal, and of course, construction of a vast network of roads and rail, which included the Trans-Himalayan Railway from Keirung to Kathmandu. During this time, the United States entered the picture with a full-scale effort to disparage the Belt and Road Initiative funding in Nepal and to promote the use of Millennium Challenge Corporation's money there instead. Under U.S. pressure, in September of 2017, the government of Nepal signed an agreement with the United States called the Nepal Compact. This agreement, worth $500 million, is for an electricity transmission project and for a road maintenance project. After both deals had been signed, a political dispute broke out in Nepal, which resulted in the split of the Communist Party of Nepal and the fall of the leftist government. One major issue on the table was the Millennium Challenge Corporation and its role in the overall Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States, which seems to be targeted against China.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. We'll be talking to the founders of Palestine Action this week, a group that successfully chased Israel's largest arms company from its London headquarters and forced it to sell its subsidiary for Anti-Technologies in Oldham. I'll be speaking to experts to find out more after this report by Bianca Rahimi on this unprecedented victory against Israel in the UK.
The heroic Palestine Action campaign against the largest Israeli arms company, Elbit Systems, has taken many twists and turns. From activists being arrested and placed on remand to many being acquitted from court cases, even by magistrates, one thing has remained true. Elbit Systems fears the disinfectant of sunlight. As Israel's number one manufacturer of killer drones and other murder machines, Elbit Systems has a gruesome reputation. It has recently been thought to own the company which manufactured the bullet which killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla. It has also been a key player in the building of the illegal apartheid wall in the West Bank. It also has numerous large contracts with the British Ministry of Defence. Despite this, Palestine Action has again and again shut down Elbit Systems factories in the country. Just a few months ago, we reported here on Palestine Declassified that the group forced Elbit Systems to sell one of its subsidiaries in the sleepy English town of Oldham at a loss. Ferranti Technologies was sold by Elbit Systems for £9 million, which is millions of pounds less than what it was acquired for. This was thanks to the coordination of the local community and Oldham Peace and Justice alongside Palestine Action. Initially, this was contested by the company, which claimed the sale of Ferranti was merely due to a reorganizing of their portfolio. However, later in a court case, it was admitted by the UK Crown Prosecution Service that Elbit was forced out of Oldham by Palestine Action. Now, there is more great news of Elbit's retreat from the UK. We are happy to announce that the London campaign by Palestine Action has forced Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems, to abandon its London headquarters for good. This is an iconic moment in the global struggle against Israel. It has been confirmed that Elbit Systems have vacated the offices of their HQ in retreat from the marching tide of Palestine Action. Good riddance to Elbit Systems. Long live Palestine Action.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And he's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. I'm also pleased to say that we're joined today by two founders of Palestine Action. As I said at the top of the show, this is the group that shut down two Elbit Systems sites in just 6 months. This stunning achievement is a true testament to their tenacity. I'm joined in the studio by Huda Mori. She's a Palestinian-Iraqi activist who's been involved in the Palestine struggle for many, many years. And Richard Barnard joins us via Skype. Richard's another founder of Palestine Action, who I understand is currently banned from London by the Metropolitan Police. Thanks to both of you for joining us and welcome to the show. Let me start with you, if I can, Huda. I mean, how did Palestine Action force Elbit to sell its subsidiary for Ferranti Technologies in Oldham?
So the Elbit subsidiary in Oldham was actually a target for local campaigners for many years. And Palestine Action launched in July 2020, and we were determined to take direct action against all of Elbit sites in Britain in order to force them out of these towns like Oldham. And so many activists had locked on under caravans to block the roads, had locked on to the front doors to block the entrances. People had climbed on top of the roof. Some actually broke into the building and damaged the machinery and weapons that were being built in Oldham. And basically, it was a campaign of making it impossible for them to continue to operate. There were activists regularly making sure that that site was shut down. And that's really our strategy, is to continue to shut them down day in and day out in some cases until they cannot operate here anymore. Because as long as they operate, more weapons are going to be made, which is going to continue to aid the ongoing occupation and colonisation of Palestine.
What was the reaction of the local community? Excuse me.
The local community, actually in places like Oldham and also in Leicester and other places across the country where Elbit's factories are, there is a high Asian community, a high Kashmiri community, which was very frustrated, to be honest, when they found out that this factory was even there in the first place. And many of them regularly protested outside the site, week in and week out at some points. Towards the end, they had gone for 30 weeks straight, wow, going outside that factory on a weekday, you know, taking time out of their normal tasks, mm-hmm, in order to show that factory that they were not welcome there.
No, indeed. And I understand that the FBU, the fire brigade, was called out, and the fire brigade union refused to cooperate with the police in removing the protesters in Leicester as well, which was quite a thing.
Yeah.
But let me go to Richard, if I can, who's joining us, as I say, from Skype. I mean, what made you get involved in direct action, Richard? And can you say a little bit about why you've been banned from London as well?
Yeah, so it's one of my bail conditions from one of my court cases. And I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me. And I'm sorry I can't be there because of the Met Police. But actually, my bail conditions and not being out to London pales into insignificance compared to the many Palestinians living in exile across the world because of what's happening in the Israeli apartheid regime. So in terms of myself, and it's interesting what Huda said then, so I lived, it's quite a simple answer, I lived next to or very close to a factory in Kent, an Elbit factory. And when I found out what they were doing, I had to do something about it. I'm not a university educated person. I didn't have the means to go through those sort of processes. So finding out there was them there and that direct action was a way of directly stopping it without having to have massive knowledge or debate around it, I could go straight to it. And more so for me, I'd worked for a number of years with homeless people, refugees, and then asylum seekers, and in fact ended up living in a community house with lots of asylum seekers. and hearing their stories from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Palestine, and realizing that these weapons that were built just around the corner from me, were the ones that were causing them. And, you know, I'm totally up for people having freedom of movement to choose where they want to go. But these people were being forced to flee and leave because of the wars created by the British state and their friends. And therefore, for me, it felt a complete solidarity with them and going to the cause, to the root cause of it, by stopping these weapons that, as I said, were built round the corner. And as Hood has touched on, I think more and more people in these communities, these factories are often built on industrial estates or the one in Kent, for instance. There's many companies, charities, universities who work around them, and you wouldn't notice it unless it's brought to their attention, often, thankfully, now by lots of red paint all over their buildings, so no one can miss it and understand the evil that these companies perpetuate.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, as you say, Richard, and indeed Huda, the community, by and large, you know, are opposed to these sort of companies being located in their localities. And it's just odd, isn't it? I mean, how these things actually come to pass. And I wonder, David, if you could maybe tell us a little bit about the links between conservative friends of Israel, for example, and Albert. What's going on there?
Well, of course, the support for this kind of activity in the British community is very, very small. But their support for it in the political elite and in the lobbying elite is very strong. And the Conservative Friends of Israel, led by a guy called Lord Pollock, has been used as a kind of lobbying vehicle by Elbit and by other firms as well to try and make sure that their interests are protected by the government, the British government. And, of course, there's a number of different lobbying firms involved here, the Westminster Connection and others, in which Pollock also has involvement. And there's a kind of nexus of lobbying interests at Westminster which have Elbit's back. But we don't see that, and people, they come to the realization that there are these factories down the road, and they're shocked and horrified. And then, you know, the other half of that is, which we should be shocked and horrified about, is that in Westminster there are small groups of people who are determined that companies like Elbit should be allowed to continue to trade, and people like Lord Pollock, the head of the Conservative Friends of Israel, are absolutely key to that initiative. So they need to be targeted as well.
Mm, yes. I mean, and Huda, I mean, apparently there's some sort of connection between Elbit and India. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what that's all about.
Yeah, definitely. So India is actually the largest importer of arms from Israel, and often these weapons are used against the occupied Kashmiri people. And these weapons are first actually marketed as battle-tested or developed on the captive population of Gaza and on the Palestinian people. So they're used against one occupied people, developed on them, and then sent to be used on another occupied people, which just shows really our struggles are connected in terms of the resistance and the horrors that both groups face in terms of occupation. But also, it's the same companies that profit from both of them, and it also means it's the same targets that we can unite on, especially in places like we're seeing in Oldham, in Leicester, in other places where people are coming together from different communities to oppose this. And the fact that they were allowed to be, you know, I think it's quite audacious, the audacious placement of these factories in communities like Leicester, in communities like Oldham, in front of the communities whose families are basically killing back home in their own countries, but also that can also be part of their downfall and actually one of the biggest mistakes they make. And we've seen that. We've seen communities uprise against Elbit. So really, you know, the fact that, and just echoing on what you said before, I think it's really crucial that actually we know that the grassroots in this country, and actually most people, I truly believe, if you don't profit from the arms trade or benefit from it directly, you're not going to support it. The same goes for Israel's apartheid state, and it's about harnessing that community power and using it in a way which is quite powerful and directly impacts Elbit's factories and you know, harnessing the power where we have it. And that's what we're trying to do at Palestine Action.
No, indeed. I mean, you know, the weapons industry is incredibly profitable, has been up until now, and indeed it was a US president, wasn't it, 60 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower, who said, warned about the dangers of an expanding military industrial complex. I think it was he who coined that term. But let me, just before we go to the next VT, if I could ask you, Richard, how did Palestine Action chase Elbit out of its own London HQ? That's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, perseverance, I think, is a key word. I would say there was a twin campaign. There was obviously direct action starting, the very first action, public action that Palestine Action did. People went inside, including both myself and Hooded, inside their office and covered it with paint, and then went back and back and back. At the same time, there was a campaign realizing that these companies don't operate in isolation. Capitalist companies need their landlords, need their managing agents to be able to run these buildings. So there was a twin campaign, and many people took autonomous actions across the country against the managing agents of and landlords of Elbit Systems HQ to increase that pressure on them. And also, I think it culminated in 6 weeks, the final 6 weeks, with intensive direct action, one or twice a week, people going outside, covering it with paint, making it, as Hood has already described, not possible for them to go into work. And it fits into the ideas as to what wins a direct action campaign, those five key elements. One being that the actions must be disruptive. You've got to stop them being able to operate. You've got to cause some kind of disruption. They've then got to be sustained. They can't just be one-off actions, however good it is to shut down an arms factory for a day. They must happen week in, week out. The target must be single and focused on that. And key, actually, a sort of counterintuitive one, there's got to be an element of sacrifice, which is not often popular in Western secular culture, but actually, this idea of seeing people prepared to give up their freedom, whether it be for just a few hours, prepared to end up covering themselves often in red paint when they cover it over a building, brings more people to the movement. And then the fifth thing is it creates a dilemma in this case for the company. And the dilemma is it profitable for them to even operate there anymore? Is there so much disruption and so much upset for them and their landlords and their neighbors that they have to leave? So those five key elements. And I would just add it, I think there was a poetic symmetry between actions. So the first person to go into the Elbit HQ on the first public action of Palestine Action was Huda, a Palestinian. And on the final action, there were two Palestinians, including one born in Gaza, who was on the final action that closed that place down and meant that they're not operating there anymore.
You know, the resistance is rising, and not just in Palestine, but across the globe and certainly in the UK. But we're just going to have to pause it there for a moment to this report on the official response to the success of Palestine Action.
Palestine Action have Israel's largest arms manufacturer, Elbit Systems, staggering in Britain. In 6 months alone, the group has forced Elbit to sell a subsidiary in Oldham and abandon the London headquarters in Holborn. Despite battering Elbit across the map of England, not one Palestine actionist has been convicted of any crime. In fact, several have already been acquitted in a notoriously harsh magistrate's court, where the guilt of the accused is assessed by a judge rather than jury. In the past, Palestine actionists have argued that Elbit Systems fear being brought before the courts and their function as a producer of killing machines being analysed in depth by a jury consisting of members of the public. Now, Priti Patel, the former International Development Secretary, who was forced to resign for having 13 secret meetings with Israeli officials in which she offered to provide British taxpayer funds to the Zionist entity, has proposed new legislation which seems to be targeted at Palestine Action. The National Security Bill would give the British police the authority to designate places where Elbit's materials are held as prohibited spaces. It is thought that this move could grant Elbit factories a protected status. This totalitarian law would make possible life imprisonment for anyone who is judged to have behaved in a way which is prejudicial to the safety or interest of the United Kingdom. It is important to note that Elbit has several existing contracts with the Ministry of Defence to provide the British Armed Forces with hardware. Another potential indicator of Palestine Action-related state machinations is the visit of Israeli police to the London Borough of Hackney. In a tweet which was subsequently deleted following a backlash, The Hackney police proudly welcomed the Israeli police on their visit to the borough. It's been wondered by many if this visit directly relates to attempts to suppress Palestine Action and their victory roll against Elbit. The Muslim Association of Britain spoke out, condemning the visit as indefensible. Israeli police violently attacked mourners and pallbearers at Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral just a few days ago, and they routinely raid Al-Aqsa Mosque, arresting and assaulting worshippers. How were they welcomed and allowed to freely parade in one of the most ethnically diverse constituencies in London, with one of the biggest Muslim communities in the UK, given their appalling violence, racism, and Islamophobia? Judging by the swift deletion of the tweet, it seems like Hackney Police's collaboration with Israeli police has gone underground for now. The history of British collaboration with the Zionist colonization of Palestine is long and sordid. But is the campaign against Elbit deepening those bonds? What is the extent of integration between British and Israeli security services in the war against Palestine Action?
Hoda, what do you make of this new legislation that's being pushed by Priti Patel?
I think it just shows how deep the alliance is between Britain and the apartheid state. And the more and more we've taken action against Elbit systems, the more we see the state show their hand and really their true support for the colonisation of Palestine and their complete disregard for the lives of the Palestinian people who Britain has been complicit in their colonisation for over 100 years. So it's not necessarily surprising, but I think it does show as well that they're pretty desperate to crack down and stop the activities of Palestine Action. And they're currently spending a lot of time, or wasting their time, focusing on trying to legislate against us. And at the same time, many activists are spending their time trying to get rid of Elbit sites as soon as possible. So we're keeping an eye on it, but it's definitely not going to stop the activities of Palestine Action, and it won't stop the campaign to get rid of Elbit systems in this country.
No. Well, good luck with everything you're doing. But Richard, I wonder if you could maybe outline how Palestine Action differs from other pro-Palestine organisations in the UK.
Yeah, I think the first thing I want to say is there's obviously been many groups, individuals and groups doing sterling work for many years. In fact, often people, including maybe in this studio, who've been doing it for longer than some of our activists have been born. And that is all vital and important work. And we have great links with local solidarity groups and other groups, Friends of Al-Aqsa. And often there's an interchangeability between people who are involved in either ones. I think our difference is obviously we're focused solely on direct action. That's a focus on that because in this particular part of the struggle, in the struggle against the arms trade, in the struggle against Elbit systems, I'm afraid the political process is gone. And appealing to the oppressors is just never going to work. And people have tried that for many years. And obviously Corbyn was a hope for many people. But that's not going to happen. There's literally probably one MP now who might be on side. So this is a direct action focused movement that complements the other things that other people are doing. And a single focus that means that. And that's our main difference. I would also say, I think one of our maybe unintended successes is drawing many new people into the Palestinian cause from the environmental movement, from animal rights. I know, Chris, you've been on those two ones for a long time, but not everyone sees that. And these people, and especially young people, we have many people of all ages, genders, religions, but there's a high proportion of young people who I think understand that the political process is broken. They've seen the way it's treated people like you. They've seen Extinction Rebellion and other groups come forward and use similar tactics, and they understand. And they also hear the words of Palestinians who cannot wait any longer for those things and want to go straight to the source. And I think that's how we differ or complement the other things that are happening.
Well, I mean, I think your point about young people just certainly gives us hope for the future. But David, I mean, how do you see the trajectory of Elbit? I mean, do you think their retreat is going to continue?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, the pattern is beginning to be set, and let's hope it does. I mean, and this will be, if we do this, and you know, Palestine Action in the vanguard of it, then that's a first major, major victory for Palestinian solidarity work in this country, which will take things in a different direction. Of course, there are many other targets lining up behind Elbit. There are many, many ways in which both the arms industry and Zionism more generally are organized throughout this country. And they have many, many, many places where they organize, where they are based, law firms they're associated with, charities through which they work. And all of these are organizations which will, you know, line up behind Elbit as being the targets next. So I foresee this as being, you know, the beginning of a number of dominoes.
Sure.
And what we need to do is push over the first few dominoes and the rest will start to fall.
Yeah. I suppose it's just another indication, isn't it, of the growth of the resistance, as I was saying earlier. We saw how the resistance in Gaza last year pushed back the Israeli occupation forces during that bombardment, and we're seeing, you know, the fantastic work of Palestine Action, you know, in this country making such a huge impact. But, that's resulting, isn't it, Huda? I think your work, your campaigning on the Palestinian issues in being deplatformed. I think you were deplatformed, weren't you, by Constant Contact recently? And I wonder if you could say what other groups have deplatformed you as a result of your activities.
Yeah, so we've been regularly deplatformed. Many, you know, most organisations or groups rely on certain platforms such as Facebook. We got taken down from them in the first 2 months. It didn't take long. MailChimp, PayPal, DonorBox. The list goes on. But really what we saw was a pattern. And Chuffed actually told us that the reason that they were removing us was because Elbit's lawyers were threatening to sue them and that they couldn't afford to take on a lawsuit from Elbit's lawyers. So they were the only ones and the first ones to actually come forward and explain what was going on behind the background and the reasoning for these deplatforming from these sites. But really,